we're talking about growing. And sometimes in order to grow, what you have to do is retrench a little bit, go back and reestablish some foundation. That's really not the only reason I'm preaching this lesson. I just like preaching this lesson. This lesson I'm going to go over with you right now is one that I often, this is often what I do the first time I sit down and study the Bible with somebody. And it accomplishes several things. One thing that it does, we're going to go through the whole Bible. So if you've got a couple of days, just sit tight. We're going to go through the whole Bible. We're going to get a good look at the whole Bible this period. But we won't take a couple of days. But we're going to do it in such a way that if you'll pay attention and if you take notes or if you can kind of keep in mind the way that we approach this, going through a timeline of the story of the Bible, you can use this when you sit down and talk with people who don't know much about the Bible, and you can walk them through this, and it gives them an overview of the Bible in such a way, it provides a framework for everything that you might study with them thereafter. In fact, what I do with them, we're going to put a little timeline, a visual timeline on screen, and as we go through it, when I do this at the kitchen table with somebody, I'll hand them a piece of paper and I'll draw it and they'll draw it. And then when I come back the next time to study with them, I'll draw it and then they'll draw it. And then I come back the next time to study with them and they'll draw it. And pretty soon they know this timeline of the whole Bible. And then anything we study from then on, wherever we are in the Bible, we can say, now here's where we are in the Bible. And it relates everything for them. And it makes it easier to understand how the Bible is interrelated. But the other thing that it does, several things it does, another thing that it does is it provides us a reason to believe this is God's Word. And when we look at the whole story of the Bible, to me, it's an inescapable conclusion. There is plenty of evidence this has to be from God. So that's the thing, two things that I find valuable in this, and I think they're valuable for you to just kind of be retrenched in this, and also valuable for you to think about, here's a way to talk about the Bible with somebody else. So I start out with Adam and Eve. If you never knew what they looked like before, now you know. Adam and Eve. And God created everything, and he created man, male and female created he them. At the end of the first chapter, the last verse of Genesis chapter 1, it says God saw everything that he created, and it was very good. Everything was good. Then we get to chapter 3 and man sins. The woman was deceived. She gave to her husband. He ate of the forbidden fruit with her. And it was because they believed the lie. And I just, oftentimes people have some awareness of that story. And I'm not going to go through it in detail this morning. But I just draw a snake. And that represents this first sin. And what happened after that, of course, as you move forward in the book of Genesis, is rather than man saying, wow, that was really bad, and the descendants of Adam and Eve saying, wow, that was really bad when they ate of the forbidden fruit. And death came and they got driven out of the garden and were kind of excommunicated from God. And by the way, that right there is a picture of what our sin does to our relationship with God. You remember what it says in Genesis, the third chapter. God drove them out from the garden. And it's kind of interesting to me. I mean, it's not all that unusual an expression, but it's the same expression in the Greek translation of the Old Testament that's used when Jesus drove the money changers out of the temple. That's what sin did to their relationship with God. And so now what happens? Well, future generations don't learn the lesson, and sin becomes so rampant in the world that God brings a flood upon all mankind and destroys everyone except for Noah and his wife and three sons and their wives. Population of the earth starts over from this family. We come 10 generations down from Noah, and we get to Abram and his son Isaac and his son Jacob. And these individuals are very important in our understanding of the Bible story because of the promises God makes to them. God promises, first of all, let's talk about Jacob's other name. What's Jacob's other name? It's Israel. And so his descendants are going to be the children of Israel or the Israelites. So that's where this is going. But turn with me to Genesis, the 12th chapter. I have to do a little geography work here. We look at this map, and Abram originally came from far to the east, but God brought him to this land, the land of Canaan, and made some promises to him. And so we need to turn to Genesis, the 12th chapter in our Bibles. And I'm not going to do these in the order that they are in the Bible. I'm going to call your attention, first of all, to verse 2, where God says to Abram, I will make you a great nation. I don't know if you've ever thought about it, but the word nation is worded, is related to a lot of words that begin with N-A-T, nativity, natural. I can't think of all of them right now. But they are words that have to do with birth, perinatal. They're words that, and so the idea of a nation was a group of people with a common birth, that is a group of people who come from a common ancestor. Now we have, you know, nation states and then nations, and like the United States of America is just a melting pot of lots of different people. But then the idea of a nation was a group of people come from, and so when God says to Abram, I'm going to make you a great nation, what he's saying is you're going to have a whole bunch of descendants that are going to be a nation, your family, so to speak. And they're going to be great. And so we have the nation promise. And then we're going to come down to verse 5, and it says, Abram took Sarai, his wife, and Lot, his nephew, and all their possessions which they'd accumulated and the persons which they'd acquired in Haran. And they set out for the land of Canaan. And thus they came to the land of Canaan. And in verse 7, the Lord appeared to Abram and said, to your descendants, this nation that's going to come from him, I'll give this land. So he built an altar there to the Lord, who had appeared to him. So the second promise I'm going to put up here is this land promise, this promise that Abram's going to get this land. And I'm going to sum up the rest of the Old Testament for you here real quickly. The rest of the Old Testament, the rest of the book of Genesis, talks about how Abram had Isaac, and Isaac had Jacob, and Jacob had 12 sons, and those 12 sons, of course, have their children, and they're becoming a nation. They become a nation after they end up down in Egypt. But God brings them out of Egypt, and they march toward this land that was promised to them, and they go to the land, and they have to fight to get the land, and they have to fight to keep the land, and they keep having troubles keeping the land because they're not always faithful to God. And at one point, they're so not faithful to God that God lets them lose the land. In fact, they get carried off the land, and they go to some other land where they have to live away from their land, and they've lost their king, and they're kind of losing their nation, and then they're living in captivity for decades, and then they get to come back to their land finally where they wanted to go back to their land. They come back to their land, but they don't have a king, and they're looking for a king, and that's the end of the Old Testament. And so you have kind of the whole Old Testament seems to be about this nation and that land and trying to get that land and losing that land and then coming back to that land. And it's easy to wonder if you know don't know the New Testament, you don't know where this is going. What does that have to do with us? How many in here are descendants of Abraham in the flesh, biologically? I don't know. Do we have any Jews in here this morning? Any people who are just, you're, no, we don't. Many times I ask that question, there's two or three in the audience that say, yeah, I am. But for the rest of us, we're asking the question, well, if the Bible, you know, the Old Testament we just summed up, that's most of the Bible. The New Testament only covers 100 years. The Old Testament covers all the time from creation up until then. And so if that's most of the Bible, that's not about my nation, at least I don't think it is. That's not about a land that I have any, you know, plans to go to, that I'm going to. So what's the Bible have to do with me? Ultimately, what we find out is the nation that's in view there and the land that's in view there is not just the fleshly descendants of Abraham and not just the land in Canaan, but there's a third promise that we want to notice, and it's in Genesis, the 12th chapter, in verse 3, and it's the last part, the last two lines of verse 3, and God says to Abram, in you all the families, or some of your translations will say, all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. So here's the third promise, and what we're going to find out is that blessing is going to be Abram's descendant, Jesus, who's going to provide a sacrifice to solve the problem of man's sin. What you have at this point, even before we see the rest of the story of the Bible, we realize we've got one big story that starts with the problem of sin and death. Man sinned and death comes upon him. And then we get not very far into the Bible, just down to Genesis 12, and God's talking about, but I've got a blessing in mind. And that blessing is Jesus, and his death provides the solution to our sin. And his resurrection shows that he has power over death. And so what you have, the Bible is 66 books, but in fact, what we find out is one story with a beginning where there's a problem and the ending where there's a solution. And what we're going to see is that everything that happens along the way is looking forward to that solution. So what happens when we get toward the end of the book of Genesis is Jacob has had 12 sons, and he's had a favorite son, and that favorite son has been sold into Egypt by his brothers, who were jealous of him or envious of him. And so eventually the whole family goes down to live in Egypt, and they're reconciled, and they become a nation in Egypt. But they're in slavery by the time we get to the book of Exodus. So what we have on screen is the book of Genesis, and the next book of the Bible is, well, okay, so here's Egypt. All right, that was quick. So the next book of the Bible is the book of Exodus. And Exodus is going to tell the story about how God brings them out of Egypt to come back to that land, to fulfill the land promise. And Exodus, now some of you probably know what the word Exodus means. It means the way out. And when Libby and I were in Greece, and especially in Turkey, actually, where they use Greek signs too, about 5 years ago, we'd be driving down a limited express highway, an expressway, and there'd be an off-ramp where you could get off. And whereas our off-ramps say exit, theirs say Exodus. That's what that word means. It's the way out. And so that book of the Bible is about the way out, God bringing the people out of Egypt, because he's promised Abraham's descendants are going to be this great nation, but they're going to be giving this land, the land of Canaan. And so they come out, and they come to Mount Sinai, and God gives them the law, the Ten Commandments. You can see the tablets there on top of the mountain. And he gives them a lot of laws and instructions about priests and sacrifices and the tabernacle, and all of that points to Jesus. But then after 40 years in the wilderness, they come into the land of Canaan. So here we come back to our map, and they leave Egypt. They come. The traditional site where people have thought Mount Sinai is down here. There's some debate about that, but I'm comfortable with that unless somebody proves otherwise to me. And then they come up here, and they spend about 40 years in the wilderness, and eventually come around, huh, and cross into the land of Canaan. And later on, they'll have the temple built at Jerusalem. So that brings us down to the time when they are living in the land and they get kings. And the first king is Saul, and he's not faithful to the Lord. So the Lord says, you know, your son could have been king after you, and your throne established, but you were not faithful. So I've chosen a man after my own heart, and David is the next king. And God says, your kingdom is going to be established forever. And of course, when Jesus comes, he's the son of David, descendant of David. That's where this is going. So Solomon, David's son, builds the temple in Jerusalem. We'll come back to that thought in a moment. But Solomon also sins in such a way that God says the kingdom is going to be divided, and 10 tribes form the northern part that's called Israel, and the other part is the southern part called Judah. And both of these parts of the kingdom, both of these kingdoms, turn away from God and worship idols, and as a result, God allows them to be conquered and carried away, the northern kingdom by the Assyrians and the southern kingdom by the Babylonians. And they all end up in captivity under the Babylonians. And after some decades, the Babylonians are defeated and the Persians come along. The Persians allow these Israelites, these Jews, to go back to their land, and many of them do, not all of them by any stretch of the imagination, but many do. And that's your Old Testament. And then we come to the New Testament and you have Jesus. So there's our framework. There's our timeline. Now, what we want to see is that this is indeed one story, and that we don't just have a bunch of random stories, and we're not just getting a history for the sake of getting history, but that we are getting one story that inexorably moves toward Christ. So oftentimes, you may ask people, and sometimes the way I've started this study, I'll ask people, name something in the Bible when we first start drawing the timeline. Name something in the Bible. And you can have to prime them up a little bit. Panic and they go, I can't think of anything. I said, well, Jesus was born of a virgin. Yes, virgin. And so we'll put Jesus down there or something and say, the Ten Commandments. And then Noah built an ark. Yes, the ark. Okay, so then they say those things and you draw the, then you say, okay, what order did those things happen in? And they have no clue. You know, I don't know, was the ark first or the Ten Commandments or Jesus born of a virgin? They don't know. But this framework helps them get things ordered. And now, okay, here's the order things happen in. But now let's look at some of these stories. We're going to pick three to illustrate the fact that everything that happens is anticipating where it's going. And the first one is in the life of Abram and Isaac. Let's go back to Genesis, the 22nd chapter. So So God has made these promises to Abram, and then eventually he tells him these promises are going to be fulfilled in his son Isaac. Isaac is the one. And so then we come to Genesis 22, and it came about after these things that God tested Abraham, now his name's been changed to Abraham, and said to him, Abraham, and he said, here I am. And he said, take now your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains, of which I will tell you. How many of you know this story right here? Raise your hand if you know this story. All right, I'm going to sum up the story real quickly. Abraham's willing to do it. He heads to this mountain with Isaac. He takes him up the mountain. He ties him up, puts him on the altar, builds an altar, ties him up, puts him on the altar, raises the knife, is about to kill him, and a voice comes and says, Abraham, Abraham, do not stretch out your hand against the lamb. And Abraham sees a ram in the bushes, and he takes the ram and he offers the ram instead of Isaac. And then God repeats these promises that we've already talked about, repeats these promises. But if you're paying attention, you who know the Bible, if you're paying attention, you look at verse 2, and there are several things that ought to jump out at you. Well, first of all, even before we do that, just think of the idea of a man being told, take now your son, your only son, whom you love, and offer him as a burnt offering. Kill him. That's just, Justin, you've got a son here. David, you've got a son here. Just imagine being told by God to do that. And we look at that story and we say, wow, Abraham had tremendous faith that he was able to do that. And that's right. But the book of Hebrews talks about that. It says, by faith, Abraham did this. And the point of the book of Hebrews is not to say, wow, that was amazing. I could never do that. The point of the book of Hebrews chapter 11 is, this is the kind of faith we need to have. That's a challenge. But it gets even more challenging when we realize that God has already told Abraham, you're going to have a great nation come from you, and they're going to get the land, and all that's going to happen through Isaac, his descendants. And Isaac's got to grow up, get married, and have kids for that to happen. Now, the same God that told you all this is going to come through Isaac says, kill Isaac. Have you ever looked at some things that are in the Bible where God tells you this and God tells you that, and you kind of scratch your head saying, how can both of those be? That's the situation that Abraham is in. How can both of those be? And Hebrews 11 makes a point of saying, he who had gladly received the promises, what promises? The ones that tell you that Isaac is going to, and now you've got to kill Isaac. Making a point of how difficult this was for Abraham. It'd be difficult for any father, but for a man who'd been told by God, these things are going to happen, and then he says, kill Isaac. Tremendous faith. But there's some other things that ought to jump out at you here. It says, take now your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac. Some of you know that Abraham had another son before Isaac was born. Do you remember that? Ishmael. In fact, Ishmael had been born 14 years before Isaac. For 14 years, Ishmael had been Abraham's only son. So that when Ishmael is about 13 years old, Abraham's 99 years old, and God tells him, you're going to have this son Isaac, and great things are going to happen through Isaac. Abraham's response was, oh, that Ishmael might live before you. Abraham is thinking, this is all in Ishmael, and now God says, no, it's in Isaac. Did he love Ishmael? Apparently he did. It bothered him when Sarah, his wife, wanted to get rid of Hagar, the mother of Ishmael, and get rid of Ishmael. And yet God calls Isaac, your son, your only son, whom you love. Why does it say it that way? There are some things that are unique about Isaac. Isaac is the only son of promise. Isaac is the only son of the free woman. Isaac is the only son still home. Ishmael had left home in chapter 21, the chapter before this. So you can justify the language, and yet it seems to be going out of its way to say, take now Isaac, your only son, whom you love. And you have to ask the question, why would it say it that way? You see where it's going? Does that only son whom you love, does that ring a bell at all? And he says, go to the land of Moriah, to one of the mountains there, which I'll show you, and offer him as a burnt offering there. If I'm going to have to kill my son, why do I have to take him to the land of Moriah to do it? It's 3 days' journey. Can you imagine trudging 3 days? Some of y'all walked around New York City for a whole day recently. Imagine 3 days' journey, the whole way having people, when I get there, I gotta kill my son. Can't just get this off. If I'm gonna do it, can I just get it over with now? Why do I have to go to Moriah? Must be something special about that place, Moriah. And the word Moriah never occurs again in the whole Bible except one time. It's in 2 Chronicles chapter 3 and verse 1. In that passage, Solomon, remember we said Solomon built the temple in Jerusalem? In that passage, it tells us he built the temple in Jerusalem on Mount Moriah. Well, what happened later on in Jerusalem? An only son whom somebody loved being sacrificed. And all of a sudden we go, is this story about Jesus? We come on down in the story in Genesis chapter 22. And it says in verse 3, Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey. He had two young men with him, apparently servants. And on the third day, verse 4, Abraham raised his eyes and saw the place from a distance. And in verse 5, Abraham said to his young men, stay here with the donkey, and I and the lad will go yonder, and we will worship and return to you. How many of you have the New King James Version? Raise your hand if you have the New King James. You do? Okay. In the New King James, it says, we will worship and we will return. And that's right. It is, the return is plural. The verb is, we are going to return. So wait a minute. He's telling the young men, stay here. Isaac and I are going to go up there and we're going to do our thing and then we're going to return. And yet, what's he going to do when he gets up there? So what's this, we will return business? Every now and then I'll ask somebody, why do you think he said, we will return? And they'll say, well, he didn't want Isaac to know what was up. But that's not it. That's not it. Turn over to Hebrews, the 11th chapter. In Hebrews, the 11th chapter, verse 17, this is our passage. By faith, Abraham, being tried or tested, offered up Isaac. Yea, he that had gladly received the promises was offering up his only begotten son. Who's the one through whom those promises are going to come? Notice that it calls him his what? This translation says, only begotten son. Some of your Bibles may say, unique son. What translation are you using? That one. Does ESV say unique? Well, some of your Bibles are going to say, only begotten. Some are going to say unique. Some of your Bibles may say one and only. Only. What I want you to understand is, that it uses an expression that's only, if I remember right, used five times in the New Testament. One of those is John 3:16, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. One of those is John 1:18, where it says, no man has seen God at any time but the only begotten. In fact, I think if I remember right, it's either three or four of those times are either Jesus or this one here, where it's talking about Isaac. And it's talking about Isaac in language that parallels Jesus. And then it goes on and it says, verse 18, even he, Abraham, to whom it was said, and Isaac shall thy seed be called. The writer's just emphasizing, God has already promised to Abraham, great things are going to come through Isaac. Now he says, offer him as a sacrifice. And so Abraham had to say in his own head, somehow both of these things have to be true. And that's faith. That's faith. When we don't entirely understand everything, but we know God said it, and we say, okay, that's true. And sometimes there are things that we struggle with, and we may come up with some kind of explanation as to maybe how both those things can be true, and we may be right or we may be wrong, but we just have to act in accordance with what God called upon us because of faith. God said it, it's true. And that's what Abraham did. He came up with an idea in his own head as to how both those things can be true. I'm going to kill Isaac, and we're going to come back down the mountain after I kill him. I'm going to kill Isaac, and God's still going to keep his promises. How could both those things be true? Well, it tells us what he was thinking in verse 19. He was accounting that God is able to raise up even from the dead. Abraham was thinking, I'm going to go up there, I'm going to kill Isaac. And then God's going to raise him from the dead. We're going to come back down from the mountain and a great nation will come from him and so on. Now that's not exactly what God did. But the writer of the book of Hebrews says in the rest of the verse, from whence, from the dead, in a figure, he did also receive him back. What he says is, figuratively speaking, Abraham got his son back from the dead. Now what have we already seen? Only begotten. We've seen Moriah, that's where Jesus is sacrificed. Take now your son, your only son. this seems to be a story about what God is going to do with his son that's parallel to what's happening with Abraham and Isaac and what happened after God's son was crucified. He came back from the dead. Notice something else here in Genesis chapter 22. It says in verse 6, Abraham took the wood. They've got to have some wood for the fire. He took the wood of the burnt offering, laid it on Isaac, his son. Isaac's carrying the wood for his own sacrifice. Does that ring a bell? Do you remember anything about John 19, I think it's verse 7, Jesus carried the cross? And he took in his hand the fire and the knife, so the two of them walked on together. And Isaac spoke to Abraham, his father, and said, "My father." And he said, "Here I am, my son." And he said, "Behold the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering?" If you're Abraham, if you're the father, and you're going to sacrifice your son, he says, "Dad, where's the animal? Where's the lamb? What do you tell him?" Well, you would be in a tough spot. But Abraham said, "God will provide. The Lord will provide." And in the end, what Abraham does is he names this place. Verse 14, Abraham called the name of that place, "The Lord will provide." As it is said to this day, in the mount of the Lord, it will be provided. That's future looking. That's talking about, and it's going to go ahead in the next few verses, and you're going to see the promises being repeated that were made earlier that we talked about, the blessing that's going to come, and all nations of the earth being blessed in verse 18. God is going to provide a blessing for all nations, all families of the earth in this mountain. That's what this story is about. It is a story about a test. It is a story about faith. But it's a story about what God is going to do. It's a story about where this whole story is going. Next story that I want to look at with you is in Genesis, the 28th chapter. We get down to Jacob. And I'm not going to go back and set the context. Let's just say Jacob was on a trip. He was on a journey. And leave it at that. And come to verse 10. And it says, Jacob departed from Beersheba and went toward Haran. And he came to a certain place and spent the night there. Why did he spend the night there? It says, because the sun had set. Just notice that phrase. Because the sun had set. And he took one of the stones of the place and put it under his head and lay down in that place. So he's resting his head on a stone because the sun has set. And he has a dream. He had a dream, and behold, a ladder. Let's just pause right here. How many of you had a dream last night? Anybody had a dream last night? You had a dream, you had a dream, you had a dream. JJ had a dream last night. You think we'd be interested in hearing about your dream right now?
Probably not.
Dreams don't make much sense, do they? No, they don't. Sometimes they're fun to talk about, but they really don't point to them. The writer of the book of Genesis is a good writer, I believe Moses. He's somebody who can tell a good story. Anybody can sit down and start reading through the book of Genesis, and this is just fascinating. This is just interesting. You can make a mini-series out of it. They used to have mini-series on TV. And yet, there's this story, and we're told what he dreamed. Apparently, it was important for us to know what he dreamed. Why was that important? Well, what's the dream? Well, we come on down in the chapter, and it says, verse 12, he had a dream, and behold, a ladder was set on the earth with its top reaching to heaven. And behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. So now we can go back and we can actually get a visual of what he saw in his dream. There you go. And that's what angels look like. And there's the cloud up there represents heaven above and then the earth below. And there's a ladder connecting the two. And angels going back and forth. What happened back here in the beginning when man sinned? God drove man out of the garden. Man is separated from God. What's this picture down here that Jacob seeing in his dream? It's a picture of restoration, of fellowship, of communication between heaven and earth, between God and man. And we're told what he dreamed. And God is in the dream, and he's above the ladder. And at the top of the ladder, he says, in verse 14, your descendants
Verse 13, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham, the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie, here's the land promise, I'll give it to you and to your descendants. Verse 14, your descendants shall also be like the dust of the earth, and you shall spread out to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south. There's the nation, great nation promise. There's going to be a lot of them. And in you and in your descendants shall all the families of the earth be blessed. And there's that third promise. The dream is about that blessing. Turn over to John chapter 1 and verse 51, the last verse of the first chapter of the book of John. And Jesus is talking about talking with Nathanael. We talked last night about when Philip brought Nathanael to Jesus. And in John chapter 1, verse 51, Jesus says to Nathanael, he says, verily, verily, I say unto you, you shall see heaven open and the angels of God ascending and descending upon. Stop there. The stories of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob were foundational stories for the Jewish nation. Jews grew up knowing those stories. They know the story of Jacob. If you're a Jew and you're listening to Jesus and he's saying, you're going to see the heavens have opened and the angels of God ascending and descending upon, what might come to mind? Upon a ladder. But he doesn't say upon a ladder. He says upon the Son of Man. The Son of Man was an expression that Jesus used for himself. It has its roots in Daniel, the 7th chapter. As one like unto the Son of Man is to receive the kingdom. It becomes shorthand for the Messiah, the Christ. You're going to see the angels of God ascending and descending, not upon a ladder, upon me. In other words, Jesus puts himself in the place of the ladder. In other words, Jesus is the one that connects heaven or earth to heaven, connects man back to God. And he's going to do that by his sacrifice. And Jacob dreamed that. Genesis 28th chapter. And the writer of the book of Genesis thought it was important that we know what Jacob dreamed. As a matter of fact, let's go back there one more time to Genesis 28th chapter. And as we come down in this text, Jacob wakes up and he builds an altar. And where he was a place that had been named Luz, but he gives it a new name in verse 19. He calls it Bethel, which means house of God. So I want you to remember some details in this story. I want you to remember that the sun had set, and that he used the stone for a pillow, and the ladder, of course, and the angels of God ascending and descending upon it, and that he named this place Bethel. I want you to remember those things. We'll come back to that in a moment. And the last thing that we're going to do this morning is talk about something that happens after the descendants of Jacob. Now there's a whole bunch of them, and I would say a couple million or so, and they're slaves down in Egypt at this point. And God is going to bring them out of Egypt. And so in order to get the ruler of Egypt, Pharaoh, to let them go, he's going to bring plagues upon the Egyptians. And there are going to be 10 of them. And the last one is going to be the death of the oldest child, the death of the firstborn son in each house, including Pharaoh's house. Turn to Exodus chapter 11. In Exodus chapter 11 and verse 1, now the Lord spoke to Moses one more plague, and he said, the Lord spoke to Moses, one more plague I will bring on Pharaoh and on Egypt, and after that he will let you go from here. And then we come down to verse 4, and Moses said to the people, thus says the Lord, about midnight I'm going out into the midst of Egypt, and all the firstborn in the land of Egypt shall die. From the firstborn of the Pharaoh who sits on his throne, even to the firstborn of the slave girl who's beneath the millstones, all the firstborn of the cattle as well. And he goes on, and the rest of the chapter basically says, it's only going to happen to the Egyptians, it's not going to happen to the Israelites. And we come to chapter 12. And how's that going to be? How's it only going to happen to the Egyptians and not to the Israelites? Chapter 12. So in chapter 12, verse 3, God tells Moses, speak to all the congregation of Israel, saying, on the 10th of this month, they are each one to take a lamb for themselves, according to their father's household, a lamb for each household. And it goes ahead and explains, you know, you're going to eat these lambs, and if you've got too small a family to eat a whole lamb, you can share it with your neighbors. But he says in verse 6, you shall keep it until the 14th day of the same month, and then the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel is to kill it at twilight. They all kill their lambs at the evening of the 14th, or the twilight after the 14th. But they're supposed to, in verse 7, take some of the blood of the lamb and put it on the two doorposts and on the lintel of the houses in which they eat it. So doorposts would be on either side and they would support the header, the lintel across the top, and they're supposed to smear the blood of the lamb on these surfaces here.
Fine.
Let's come on down in the chapter, and we get to verse 8 and 9, and the instructions about how to cook it, eat it with unleavened bread, no leaven present, and then how they're to be dressed in verse 11. You shall eat it in this manner, with your loins girded, sandals on your feet, staff in your hand. That's traveling mode. You've got your shoes on, you've got your robes hitched up under your belt so you're ready to go, you've got your staff in your hand, because the Lord's going to let you go tonight. And here's what's going to happen on the night when they do this. And he explains, you shall eat it in this manner, and he explains the manner. He says, you shall eat it in haste. It's the Lord's Passover. For I will go through the land of Egypt on that night, and I will strike down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast, and against all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgments. I am the Lord. The blood that they smeared over the doorposts and lintel, the blood of the lamb shall be a sign for you on the houses where you live. And when I see the blood, I'll pass over you, and no plague will befall you to destroy you when I strike the land of Egypt. So the Israelites would do this, and their firstborn would not die. But the Egyptians would not do this, and their firstborn would die. And the text goes on to say, and every year after this, you're going to observe this. You're going to commemorate this. You're going to keep the Passover feast as a memorial of this. And the Jews did this down through the centuries. And they were still doing it in New Testament times. I'll come back to that thought just a moment. We still see Passover on our calendars now every year, right? It's an interesting story. Don't you find that that's an interesting story? I think that's just an interesting story. I think everybody, when they read this story for the first time, they think, wow, that's an interesting story. But then you stop and think about it. Could you have thought of a less messy way to let God know which house is an Israelite house? I mean, the idea, I'm going to kill lamb, spears, blood all over the place. Why not maybe just take a 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper, stick it on the door, and say, Israelite house? Or maybe just an eye. Or for that matter, if God is God, doesn't he already know which ones are Israelite houses? So why in the world go through this process of killing a lamb and spearing blood all over the doorpost and the lintel? Do you know why? Well, think about it this way. Could you say that because God did it this way, would it be fair to say they were saved from death? In those houses, they were saved from death by the blood of the lamb? When you say it that way, does it all come home to you and you realize what this story is about? What did we say John said? John the Baptist said when he saw Jesus, behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. In 1 Corinthians, the 5th chapter, in verse 7, when Paul is talking about needing to get sin out of the congregation, it's represented by leaven, and he talks about we've got to get sin out of the congregation and be unleavened so that we can keep fellowship, keep the feast with Christ. And he calls him our Passover lamb. He calls Christ our Passover lamb. Do you remember what Jesus did the night before he was crucified? We've alluded to it a couple of times already in the last night or Friday night. He ate what we call, what do we say he ate the night before he was crucified? We say he ate the Last Supper. Does the Bible call it the Last Supper? No, we call it the Last Supper because it was the Last Supper before he was crucified. But you know what the Bible calls it? It tells us it was Passover. What does that tell you? Jesus is crucified at the time of the annual celebration of God's people being saved from death by the blood of the Lamb, of the original Passover. How'd that happen? So I want you to think about a couple of things that we've noticed here. We've got interesting stories. They end up seeming to parallel or anticipate what's happening in Jesus, but there are also things about these stories that are inexplicable if they're not about Jesus. Why in the world in Genesis 22 did it say, take now your son, your only son? Why in the world say, go to the land of Moriah? Why even tell the readers that it was the land of Moriah when that's not a term that ever shows up in the Old Testament again, except for once when it's talked about Jerusalem, where Jesus ends up in the temple. In the story of Jacob's dream, why do we need to know what his dream was? And it's not like some other dreams in the Old Testament where it tells us a dream because it's going to tell us the interpretation of the dream.
It just tells us the dream. Why in the world did we need to know what he dreamed? And in this last story, what a weird way, what a strange way to let God know which are Israelite houses, kill a lamb, smear his blood over the doorpost and lintel. That doesn't make any sense unless there's some meaning to it. And they were saved from death by the blood of the lamb, and it points to Jesus. So what do we have? We could go through so many things in the Old Testament, and everything just points to Jesus. And so what you have, you know, you read a book sometimes, and you'll be in chapter one of the book, and there'll be some little detail. I'm talking about a novel now. And there'll be some little detail, and you don't pay a lot of attention to it. I mean, you read it, you notice it, but I don't know why the detail's there. And then you get to chapter 26, and the whole story comes together, and boom, wow, that's why that detail was back there in chapter 1. Have you ever had that experience? How does that happen? You know how it happens. The guy who wrote chapter 1 is the same guy who wrote chapter 26, and he knew what he's going to put in chapter 26 when he wrote chapter 1, right? What do we have here? We've got a book, one big book, one story, and there's stuff, there's details all in the first part of it that you get to the end of it, you go, wow, that's why Jacob had that dream. That's why I said, take now your son, your only son. That's why they had to put the blood on the doorpost and the lintel. How'd that happen? Because there's one author behind the human authors, and he knew what he was going to put in chapter 26. When he had not only chapter 1 written, but when he had chapter 1 happen. So we see a picture of a God who's in control of history and a God who's in control of the telling of the story. And then you start thinking about, I'm going to skip this. We could look at the tabernacle layout. We would again see it's about Jesus. But I'm going to skip all of that. I just want to come to this. The whole Old Testament, the whole Bible is written by approximately 40 people. How many people we have in here? Five, 15. We got a little over 40 people, 40-ish in here right now. Suppose I asked every one of you right now, I said, everybody take the next hour, write a chapter. When you're done, turn them in. I could give you a topic. Write a chapter about Israel and Hamas. Write a chapter about the Philadelphia Eagles. I don't care. When you got done and you turned them all in, do you think I'd have a book as cohesive, as linear, as progressive from beginning to end, with the beginning always anticipating the end, looking forward to the future as the Bible is? And the thing is, you 40 people live at the same time in history, in the same geographical location, and you all know each other. But these 40 people are people who, well, wrote the Bible over a time span of 1,500 years. So you've got people writing 1,500 years, 1,400 years, 1,300 years, 1,000 years before the culmination, and yet they are writing things about the culmination, including details in their writings, all looking forward to where this story is going. How does that happen? Do you see why I like this study? It's a study that gives us a framework. Now we can go back. Anything we study from now on, we can plug in into the timeline where it goes. But not only that, but it's also a story that helps us see the Bible cannot be explained as the product of just human writers. Because human writers don't know the future. There are things that are miraculous. There are things that are prophecies and very amazing predictions about the future, that Jesus is going to be born in Bethlehem, or that the ruler would be coming from Bethlehem. And those are amazing, and those are impressive, and those are powerful. But to me, the pervasiveness of all the little details and all the stories that are odd in their own place but end up making sense when it comes to Jesus is such a powerful evidence that all of this is from God. I want to go back to one last thing. Turn to your songbook, number 328. We sang this song, Nearer My God to Thee. Second stanza. Though like the wanderer, the sun gone down, darkness be over me, my rest a stone. Does that ring a bell? I like this songbook because in other songbooks I've seen this, though like a wanderer.
But this psalm book has it, though, like the wanderer. It's talking about a particular wanderer, Jacob,
when he was traveling, in Genesis 28. And the sun had set, and his rest was a stone. Yet in my, down at the third line there, in the second stanza, yet in my dreams I'd be nearer my God to thee.
In the beginning of the story, man was separated from God, but Jacob has a dream about being near to God. And who brings man near to God? Jesus does.
The writer of this song got that. He knew what that was about. Keep looking at the song. Look at the fourth stanza. Then with my waking thoughts, bright with thy praise, so Jacob wakes up, out of my stony griefs, what did he raise?
Bethel I'll raise. What did Jacob named the place? He built an altar and named the place Bethel, house of God. The writer of this song understood Jacob's dream was about Jesus. I hope this is a useful study to you. I hope that maybe you'll remember this. And you don't have to do it exactly the way I've done it. But if you can, this has just been a helpful approach through the years to take with people I study with. I hope it's helpful to you and just reaffirmed your faith. The Bible has to be the Word of God. Because the Bible presents us with a lot of ideas. It presents us with a worldview that is so different than the view of the world that people all around us have. I need to know that when I'm reading the Bible, I'm reading the words of God. And I think this study helps us do that. Thank you for your attention this morning. It's been good to be with you. I appreciate the invitation to be with you. God bless you all.